Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Obesity and Comorbid Conditions, Clarifying the Bariatric Referral Roadmap, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Louis J. Aroney, MD, Caroline M. Apovian, MD, Francesco Rubino, MD, and Alan R. Schwartz, MD. Dr. Aroney is a clinical professor of medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College, director, Comprehensive Weight Control Program, New York Presbyterian Hospital, New York, New York. Dr. Aroney has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He received grants for clinical research from Amylin Pharmaceuticals, F. Hoffman LaRoche, and Novo Nordisk. He served as an advisor or consultant for Abbott Laboratories, Amylin Pharmaceuticals, Ethicon Endosurgery, GlaxoSmithKline Consumer Healthcare, NeuroSearch, Novo Nordisk, Orexigen Therapeutics, Takeda Pharmaceuticals North America, and Vivas. He has an ownership interest in Cardiometabolic Support Network. Dr. Aroney does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Aroney does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Apovian is a professor of medicine and pediatrics, section of endocrinology, diabetes, and nutrition, Boston University School of Medicine, director, Nutrition and Weight Management Center, Boston Medical Center, Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Apovian has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. She received grants for clinical research from Amylin Pharmaceuticals, the Dr. Robert C. and Veronica Atkins Foundation, Metaproteomics, and Orexigen Therapeutics. She served as an advisor or consultant for Abbott Laboratories, Allergan, Amylin Pharmaceuticals, Arena Pharmaceuticals, Johnson & Johnson Pharmaceutical Research and Development, Merck & Company, Orexigen Therapeutics, and Sanofi Aventis. Dr. Apovian does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Apovian does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Rubino is an associate professor of surgery, chief gastrointestinal metabolic surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York, New York. Dr. Rubino has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He received grants for clinical research from Covidien and Roche. He served as an advisor or consultant for NGM Biotech Pharmaceuticals. Dr. Rubino does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Rubino does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Schwartz is a professor of medicine, pulmonary, and sleep medicine, Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, director, Johns Hopkins Sleep Center, Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center, Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Schwartz has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He received grants for clinical research from ResMed. He served as an advisor or consultant for Apnex Medical, InSleep, and Respicardia. He owns stock, stock options, or bonds from Sova Pharmaceuticals. Dr. Schwartz does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Schwartz does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to describe the relationship between obesity and its comorbidities, such as type 2 diabetes and obstructive sleep apnea, to describe the effect of obesity on quality of life, to evaluate clinical options to reduce obesity and related comorbidities, and to develop patient counseling techniques and referral practices aimed at increasing the appropriate use of bariatric surgery to treat obesity. This activity is supported by Allergan. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, my name is Dr. Louis Aroney, clinical professor of medicine at Weill Medical College at Cornell University and adjunct associate professor of clinical medicine at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. I'm director of the Comprehensive Weight Control Program at New York Presbyterian Hospital in New York City. Welcome to this Medscape CME Spotlight panel discussion entitled Obesity and Comorbid Conditions, Clarifying the Referral Roadmap. Joining me today are Dr. Caroline M. Apovian, Professor of Medicine and Pediatrics in the section of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Nutrition at Boston University School of Medicine. She's the Director of Nutrition and Weight Management at Boston Medical Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Francesco Rubino, Associate Professor of Surgery and Chief of Gastrointestinal Metabolic Surgery at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York City. And Dr. Alan R. Schwartz, Professor of Medicine, Pulmonary and Sleep Medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the Medical Director of the Sleep Center at the Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center in Baltimore, Maryland. Welcome to our panelists. Thank you for coming. The goals of this activity are to describe the relationship between obesity and its comorbidities, such as type 2 diabetes and obstructive sleep apnea, as well as its effect on the quality of life, to evaluate the clinical options to reduce obesity and related comorbidities, and to develop patient counseling techniques and referral practices aimed at increasing the appropriate use of bariatric surgery to treat obesity. Before we begin the discussion, we would like you to gauge your current knowledge by having you answer the following questions. Today we'll be discussing treatments of patients with obesity, surgical options for obesity management, and obesity-related comorbidities, mainly diabetes and obstructive sleep apnea. Obesity is one of the most serious health problems afflicting Americans today. It is the second leading cause of reversible illness in the country. It costs about $147 billion to treat people with obesity. And if we look at obesity as an overall part of the picture, of the health picture, it's a problem that needs to be treated. And we are just beginning to develop new techniques, new strategies for treating it. We're just beginning to pay for the treatment of obesity. And to begin our discussion, Caroline will discuss the comorbidities, most importantly, diabetes and obesity. Caroline?
Thank you, Lou. Obesity is a disease in and of itself, but it also causes a lot of other conditions that we call comorbidities of obesity. The number one associated disease is type 2 diabetes. And actually, when I was in medical school, I learned that obesity was an excess body fat, but that fat tissue just sat there and was not metabolically active, and you know, you just stored fat. Mm-hmm. We now know that the fat cell is an endocrine organ, which means that it secretes peptides that go to other organ systems and cause disease. So we know obesity to be a chronic state of inflammation because fat tissue secretes agents that cause inflammation. And these agents can lead to insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes, for example. They also cause inflammation in other tissues, such as the vessels, and that's why you end up with heart disease after having obesity, as well as type 2 diabetes. So obesity really causes these other disorders or exacerbates them. For example, about 60 to 61% of type 2 diabetes in this country is directly attributable to excessive fat tissue. We also have other disorders that are related to excess fat tissue because of the hormones that fat tissue secrete. And there are even some cancers that are associated with obesity, such as in women, endometrial cancer and breast cancer because of the hormonal milieu, and in men, prostate and colon cancer in both men and women. These are all cancers that are associated with obesity. When we think about treatment, we can think about medical versus surgical options. So the NIH guidelines suggest that anyone with a body mass index over 25 is considered overweight. Over 30 is obese. Anyone who has a BMI over 25 should receive diet, exercise, and lifestyle counseling to treat their obesity. With this kind of medical weight loss, you can lose 5 to 10% of your body weight. What does 5 to 10% of body weight loss mean? It means that you get a tremendous resolution or amelioration of some of these comorbidities that I was just talking about, like type 2 diabetes. You can actually see reductions in hemoglobin A1C and blood sugar with a 5 to 10% weight loss. You can also see drops in systolic and diastolic blood pressure and an improvement in lipids. An improvement in total cholesterol, LDL, an enhancement of HDL, and a reduction in triglycerides. So medically speaking, a 5 to 10% weight loss can lead to a tremendous resolution of some of these comorbidities.
Mm-hmm. I've heard the number bandied about that there are more than 50 comorbid conditions associated with obesity, and that all of them, with the exception of osteoporosis, get better with weight loss.
Well, that's true, but even osteoarthritis can get better with weight loss. So there are studies out there that show that a 5 to 10% weight loss can alleviate the pressure on the joints, so the knees and the hips and ankles, so that patients can start being more mobile. So even something like osteoarthritis can be ameliorated with a 5 to 10% weight loss. Now, of course, there are people who need to lose more than 5 to 10%, and then we have pharmacotherapeutic options and bariatric surgery that we'll be talking about.
Right. It's been difficult getting new medications approved by the FDA. What's been the concern of the FDA about new obesity treatments?
There are several concerns. The number one concern is that there are so many of us who would be eligible for these medications, because 66% of Americans are now considered overweight or obese, and about a third of us are obese and eligible for a weight loss medication according to the NHLBI guidelines. So the FDA is looking at so many people eligible for these weight loss drugs, and they want to make sure that these drugs are safe and, of course, effective. And that gets very difficult because we need these medications, because we need patients to be able to keep the weight off that they lose. And yet some of these medications do have some side effects. And some of the side effects can be cardiovascular in nature or maybe teratogenic. So what we really need in this country is more people who are trained to treat obesity and treat obesity with pharmacotherapeutic options and know what the side effects are.
Right, and that's another trend is training in obesity medicine.
That's right. So the Obesity Society, along with other societies, are engaged in a process by which we will have an obesity medicine specialty created very soon. Some of us are already practicing it now, but we'll have an exam very soon, and hopefully shortly thereafter there'll be enough physicians trained to treat obesity to take the exam and finally have a core group of physicians in this country that can treat obesity, so that the FDA feels more comfortable in approving some of these medications that we really need.
How do you manage some of the other comorbid conditions? What specific management? What about diabetes?
Well, that's a good question. So The comorbid conditions that you can manage are type 2 diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, and lipid problems. What you want to look at first is the weight. So you have a patient with a BMI of 30 who comes in with prediabetes or already type, or you diagnose a type 2 diabetes. Do you want to start that patient on a medication right away? That used to be the trend years ago. Now we really want to focus on lifestyle change to help the patient lose that 5 to 10% so that you may not have to start drugs like sulfonylureas and insulin. There are drugs that have come out recently that can help manage the obesity and treat the diabetes, such as exenatide or amylin, liraglutide, which is Victoza. And so these drugs, even though they're injectable, they help manage the diabetes by treating the obesity as well because they promote weight loss. Many of the other medications that we use, such as sulfonylureas, insulin, even the TZDs, cause weight gain and only exacerbate the problem by making the patient more obese and more insulin resistant.
Right. We'll come on to, we'll get into some of the other management issues later, but let's shift now to the issue of sleep apnea. Alan, let's talk a little bit about sleep apnea and what the issues are in sleep apnea and obesity.
Well, sleep apnea is highly linked to obesity. The background prevalence of sleep apnea in the U.S. adult population is about 2 to 4% for individuals in the community with symptomatic sleep apnea. As mild to moderate degrees of obesity ensue, sleep apnea increases dramatically in prevalence. In men, it can go up to 50% at a BMI of, say, 30. And in women, it might be roughly half that, maybe 25% of the U.S. population at that level of BMI. But as women pass through menopause, the prevalence begins to approach that of men. As you get into increasing degrees of obesity, into the category of severe obesity, say with BMIs of over 40, the prevalence rates go up dramatically. Virtually all men at that level of BMI or greater will have sleep apnea to some degree. And either two-thirds or three-quarters of the women in the U.S. adult population will have sleep apnea as well. And so the issue in extreme degrees of obesity is not so much whether it's present or not, but really how severe is it? Because your management decisions will be dictated not only by presence, but also by severity.
We often see it missed in the outpatient setting. So patients come to us and they've never been diagnosed as having sleep apnea, and yet because we see it all the time, it seems to us to be obvious. Why is that? Why are people missing the diagnosis of sleep apnea?
Primarily because it's occurring during sleep and no one's awake to detect it. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes the first indicators of sleep apnea are really the bed partners, the family members sleeping down the hall, and even the neighbors that are calling in the morning complaining of loud snoring. When snoring progresses over a period of years, or if it's so disruptive, it's usually associated with sleep apnea to some degree. And virtually every screening survey uses or incorporates the presence of snoring as one of their probability indices to increase your likelihood of having sleep apnea on a full sleep study. We also use BMI because it's a rough indicator for prevalence rates of sleep apnea. And so as you get on to the mild to moderate or severe degree of sleep apnea, you get increasing prevalences associated with increasing degrees of obesity. Beyond that, you can start to evaluate patients and consider other types of anatomic defects involving the upper airway, presence of adenotonsillar hypertrophy, for example. And the other thing about obesity, and Carolyn, you probably think about this on a day-to-day basis, I think about the fact that it's not just obesity, but it's body fat distribution that increases your likelihood of having obstructive sleep apnea. And for us, in our clinical experience, it's the apples, not the pears. The people with truncal and central adiposity that are much more likely to have sleep apnea, and really the concomitants of sleep apnea, which is the intermittent nocturnal hypoxemia that ensues from these apneic episodes. The hypoxic episodes are much more severe in people who have truncal obesity versus subcutaneous or peripheral adiposity.
We've seen patients who were not that overweight. These are people who I would not have guessed would have sleep apnea, but they in fact turned out to have it because they had all central or truncal obesities. And these were women. These were women who had gained weight through menopause, and they acutely developed sleep apnea. Is that a common phenomenon you see?
Absolutely. And with redistribution of body fat, as might occur across the menopause, mm-hmm. the likelihood of having sleep apnea is much greater.
Right. As far as evaluating patients, what tools do you use? One of the big questions that comes up is the sleep study, inpatient versus the home sleep study. Which is preferred? What do you use?
And do you always have to do a sleep study to diagnose sleep apnea?
So I think we should distinguish between simply diagnosing it and establishing how severe it is. Because the background prevalence rates are so high. But we also want to characterize sleep apnea in terms of its severity. And in order to do that, it's more than just a matter of mere detection of the disorder, but really establishing what its impact is acutely over the course of the night and also on daytime functioning. What I mean by that is that apneic episodes acutely at night cause intermittent arousals from sleep. And from that, we get increasing degrees of sleep disruption to frank insomnia. And then as sleep apnea ensues and you get increasing amounts of sleep disruption and nocturnal hypoxemia, you find that there's increasing daytime manifestations of sleep apnea. And those are protean manifestations. People can be frankly hypersomnolent, or they can present with nonspecific daytime fatigue. There are mood changes, depressive features associated with it, short-tempered, disgruntlement, and a bunch of other sort of psychophysiologic changes. In addition, though, sleep apnea causes increases in hypertension. There's a carryover effect from these acute physiologic perturbations at night that leads to an overall elevation of blood pressure during the daytime. There's elevations of glucose and problems with glucose homeostasis that result over years from exposure to sleep apnea at night. And then in acute physiologic and chronic physiologic exposures to sleep apnea in animal models, what we see are metabolic disturbances and frank cardiovascular disease, atherosclerotic disease, and heart failure.
Right. An excellent description of the entire picture that we spend so much of our time trying to manage. And to talk about management, let's see what you have to say, Francesco. I mean, this is a problem that you and I discuss all the time. Many of our patients lose weight, but they don't lose enough to treat their sleep apnea. That's something I'd like to come back to later. How much do you have to lose to treat the sleep apnea? But let's talk about the surgical management of obesity. What types of treatments are currently available? What types of procedures are you currently performing?
Well, first of all, let me tell you that bariatric surgery is becoming popular nowadays, but as a matter of fact, has been around for more than 60, 70 years. Actually, it started in the 50s, in the early 50s, and the idea was that you could reduce body weight by reducing the size of the stomach and creating some sort of malabsorption for nutrients by rerouting the passage of nutrients through the small bowel. So as a result, over the years, there have been many procedures that have raised and fallen. Based on this idea of putting together restriction and malabsorption and playing with those kind of mechanisms. Now today we know that this is a very outdated way of looking at bariatric surgery. As a matter of fact, we know that the gastrointestinal tract is an endocrine organ. And so that the idea is now that some of these procedures are capable not only of reducing the amount of food somebody can eat at every meal, but basically influencing the feeling of satiety, hunger, the secretion of insulin, even sensitivity to insulin. So today we have the most common procedures are basically four, extending from perhaps the most simple, which is the gastric banding. It's a gastric banding is a very simple concept. There is a band that is adjustable in size and diameter that is placed around the upper part of the stomach. This band is connected to a reservoir that is under the skin and can be inflated in order to adjust the restriction over time. and basically restricting the amount of food that every patient can eat at every meal. So that's the concept behind the band. Then we have other procedures that are more complex. Gastric bypass, for instance, perhaps the most common procedure for obesity is a combination of stomach and intestinal surgery. There is a small gastric pouch that is created in substantial bypass of the upper portion of the small bowel. And then there is another procedure called biliopancreatic diversion duodenal switch, which is similar in concept to gastric bypass, but with a, if you will, a much more extensive bypass of the small bowel, creating a much greater potential for malabsorption. As a result, this procedure is potentially exposed to a greater side effect from a nutritional standpoint, and in fact is not one of the most common. It is performed more rarely in patients whose BMI is perhaps too high to hope that more simple procedures could achieve sufficient weight loss. And then in the last few years, we have seen the surge of interest for sleeve gastrectomy, a operation that basically remove a portion of the stomach and creates a vertical sleeved-shaped reservoir stomach, removing the stomach along the greater curvature. This procedure is restrictive in a way, but it's becoming more and more accepted. It is also a metabolic procedure. As a matter of fact, the stomach itself has produces hormones that are affected by this resection, and in that fashion, you can influence satiety, appetite, and body weight.
So what procedures do we do in any given situation, and what's the risk of the different bariatric procedures?
Well, first of all, all these procedures today are most commonly performed by a laparoscopic approach, a minimal invasive approach that has, over the years, reduced dramatically the potential for immediate complications of surgery. So these procedures are overall quite safe nowadays, much more than just simply a decade ago or 20 years ago. And in practice, each of these procedures may have also specific side effects. Of course, if you are talking about gastric bypass or biliopancreatic diversion, where there is a bypass of the small bowel, there are more concerns about the long-term nutritional side effects, particularly reduction of vitamin absorption. Whereas surgical procedures that are limited to the stomach may have less such risks, but of course, retain the risk of impairment of gastric emptying and so determining some sort of side effects in terms of nausea or vomiting, particularly when you have a gastric bending that reduces the size of the stomach. There is a fine balance to reach so that you achieve weight loss, but you don't induce too frequent vomiting or nausea. So it depends on the type of procedure.
Right. So let's talk about airway management. Now, this is an issue that comes up. How do you manage the patient with sleep apnea through the surgical procedure, and particularly after they have a few holes in them, they have some abdominal pain, they're taking narcotics? How do you make sure that that patient is safe?
Well, the first step is really to detect the disorder actually before the operation, long before the operation, preferably. And that really speaks to the point that the sleep study is probably the best surrogate for detection of airway complications in the immediate postoperative period. Patients with sleep apnea experience collapse of their upper airway, their pharynx, during sleep. And in fact, REM sleep is really the stress test for the upper airway. And what happens during REM sleep in terms of apnea severity often predicts or is associated with the postoperative complications that are so dread. During the operation, anesthesiologists, particularly in overweight individuals, are all attuned to the fact that they should be very cautious on intubation. And awake fiber optic intubation is often practiced as a precautionary maneuver so you don't lose the airway at the time that you're inducing anesthesia. In the immediate postoperative period, you speak to the fact that patients are sedated and under the influence of analgesics, all of which are known to suppress certain airway reflexes that maintain airway patency, both during sleep and in the immediate postoperative period. And so these individuals who have sleep apnea, if we want to preclude airway complications, we want to get them started on CPAP preoperatively, enough before the operation that they actually have a little bit of time to acclimatize to the nasal CPAP device, can carry it to the hospital with them, and it can be used and put on for the ensuing postoperative course. The bottom line, if you have a patient with sleep apnea, he's much more likely to develop postoperative complications immediately postoperative, and they vary from cardiopulmonary problems, ICU stays, and increased length of stay in the hospital. And then if you intervene with CPAP, there is some evidence now to suggest that early CPAP intervention in the immediate postoperative period will actually decrease your complication rate.
Which patients are at particular risk in going through surgery? Are there people who we really have to watch out for to get them through surgery safely?
We should also be mindful of the fact that severe obesity is also associated with other comorbid respiratory conditions. We know the example in the extreme case of the Pickwickian syndrome. And these are patients who experience daytime hypoxemia as well as hypercapnia. These are individuals who are really very predisposed to developing respiratory failure in the immediate postoperative period. And so detection of an elevated bicarbonate on screening laboratories might be a clue that there is some degree of baseline hypoventilation and hypercapnia. These are people we want to be particularly vigilant about, maintain their ventilatory support in the postoperative period, and monitor them very closely for respiratory failure and the need for reintubation.
Right.
We should also talk about the the use of preoperative weight loss prior to bariatric surgery to alleviate some of the severe comorbidities. So a 5 to 10% weight loss can quickly alleviate some of the obstructive sleep apnea and also elevated blood sugar, fatty liver, so that the surgeon can really see what you're supposed to see during the operation. So in many centers now, patients are asked to try and lose 5 to 10% of their body weight even before undergoing bariatric surgery.
And in ours, it's actually a condition to qualify for the surgery.
Mm-hmm. We often ask patients to stay on a low-calorie diet for a few days before surgery because, as Carolyn said, there is a dramatic effect on the size of the liver. The fatty liver responds very, very rapidly and impressively to just a short period of decreased caloric intake. And for us, it makes a big difference to operate on, in an area where the liver is not extremely enlarged, because it makes the operation simpler and potentially more expeditious.
Now, one question I'm often asked is the criteria we use for selecting patients for bariatric surgery and how to select a procedure for a given patient. Caroline, how do you decide which patient gets what procedure?
Well, first, it's important to have a discussion with the patient. Certainly, there are many patients who I see who perceive, and rightly so, that the gastric banding is less risky and, shall we say, more of a reversible procedure, even though we really don't want it to be reversed. And
right.
So because bariatric surgery is still perceived by many as this very risky operation, it may be easier to steer someone like that to gastric banding. Understanding that usually with gastric banding you don't get as much weight loss as you would with a gastric bypass, for example. So if your patient needs to lose 100 to 150 pounds, I try very hard to talk to the patient about the benefits of something like the gastric bypass or even the sleeve gastrectomy. In my state, we don't do the biliopancreatic diversion. So that's one aspect. Certainly, if you have a patient who has a history of alcohol abuse, it may be more risky to steer them towards a gastric bypass because of the vitamin and mineral deficiencies that they may suffer from after surgery. So that patient would be more amenable risk taking for the gastric bypass. If If you have, you need to talk to the patient, of course, that gastric banding, at least initially, would require the patient to come in every few months for follow-up and possible fills of the band and adjustments to the band. So the patient needs to understand that frequent visits to the doctor are going to be necessary. That's also true for the gastric bypass, but the gastric bypass is a much more, you're going to lose weight much more quickly with the bypass, and after the first year or so post-op, that patient will be coming in hopefully every year. So there are different follow-up procedures that you can compare. The lap band and the gastric bypass, they're going to be different. So you need to talk to your patient about all these things.
Let me add to what you just said, that in the past, unfortunately, bariatric surgery is being used in a way that was almost not related to the individual characteristics. So patients sometimes have heard about gastric banding and they want to have the gastric banding, or they heard a friend who had a gastric bypass and go for that procedure. I think we are moving towards a patient, a more tailored approach. Patient-specific characteristics make a difference as to whether one or another operation may be best suited. To make an example, we discussed briefly about the benefits of bariatric surgery, and weight loss is, of course, one of the most evident. But what is perhaps even more important is the fact that bariatric surgery can improve, we say the sleep apnea, but can improve diabetes dramatically. Some of these patients that we operate basically are in such an improved glycemic state, and in some cases we don't see diabetes anymore. We cannot diagnose diabetes after the operation. So the advantage of bariatric surgery is not just that patients will lose weight, but it's the opportunity to improve each and every of those comorbidities, metabolic diseases, in fact, that are associated with the excess weight. So it makes a difference if a patient comes with diabetes, if diabetes is severe, diabetes has been there for many years, because as I mentioned before, gastrointestinal surgery, which is nothing else than bariatric surgery, has the potential to change the regulation, the very regulation of insulin secretion and sensitivity. So it might make a difference for a patient who has severe diabetes to have perhaps gastric bypass as opposed to a simpler procedure, simply because you have more mechanism of action at play that can address the disease more thoroughly. So that really has to do, the choice of the procedure should have something to do with the characteristic of the patients, the presence of certain comorbidities, and the severity of those comorbidities.
Right. And the best candidate for, I believe, a gastric bypass would be a patient with a high BMI who has had diabetes for maybe less than 5 years, because then the chance of completely resolving the type 2 diabetes is very high.
And that's led the International Diabetes Federation to say what?
Well, the International Diabetes Federation, which basically established many, not say guidelines, but suggestions for how to treat patients with diabetes, recently decided that there is enough evidence to consider bariatric surgery as one of the options for diabetes management. And in some patients, it's a very valuable option that should not be considered last resort, but used, as Carolyn said, early on in the disease process, so that you can go and really stop the progression or even resolve diabetes if you intervene early enough. If you wait too long, even gastric bypass might not be enough to treat a very poorly controlled and long-lasting diabetes.
Now, within the past year, lap band surgery has been approved for people with a BMI of 30 to 35, which is lower than the traditional indication for obesity, for patients with diabetes that's not controlled, and for patients with sleep apnea. Let's talk about that. Lap band surgery for BMI of 30 to 35. Now, it may not be covered by their insurance company, but the FDA has now approved that. How do you feel about that?
I think that the FDA decision goes in the same direction that now it's felt to be appropriate by the scientific community. In other words, maintaining a strictly BMI-based cutoff for surgical indication has no evidence behind to be justified. There is no, for instance, evidence that a patient who has a BMI 34 as opposed to 36 would benefit less from bariatric surgery in terms of diabetes control or any other comorbidities control. So today, the FDA has approved bending for BMI 30 to 35, and back to the International Diabetes Federation recent position statement, there is a recommendation that if BMI is between 30 and 35 and a patient has a very poorly controlled diabetes, especially if there are other cardiovascular risk factors and diabetes is difficult to control with medication, the BMI 35 should not be a reason for not to recommend surgical options.
Right. Now, interestingly, there's actually been a fall off in both surgical management and other forms of physician-directed management in the past few years. While the numbers had increased rapidly, they're now they've plateaued and they're starting to fall off. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's interesting. I see patients every day with a BMI over 40, with comorbidities, and a small fraction of those patients will consent to undergo bariatric surgery. And you would think with a low mortality rate and a low morbidity rate, with a sometimes complete cure of diabetes, why is this? Well, I think we need to realize that many patients who suffer from obesity, and others too, feel that obesity is somehow a matter of willpower, that people are just eating too much, and somehow many of my patients feel that they should be able to control their weight through willpower. We now know that obesity is a disease. There's a hypothalamic something, there's a dysfunction somewhere between the pathways that we talked about, between what happens at the fat tissue level, the gut, and the brain, that is allowing patients to be so hungry, especially after they've lost weight. Maybe easier to lose weight, but it's very, very, very difficult medically to keep the weight off. And so I think that many patients feel that this is a cop-out, unfortunately. And so I think a lot more education has to happen in the medical community and also at the patient level to finally teach people that obesity is a disease, just like diabetes and hypertension.
When do we, when do we consider patients to have failed medical and lifestyle management?
That's a very good question. That's also, you know, that should be individualized. But, you know, if you look at the NIH guidelines, which are being updated now, we say a patient really should, you know, fail medical treatment for at least 6 months of some kind of an intensive program to include diet, lifestyle change, and exercise therapy. And so that varies from patient to patient. But certainly in my patient population, patients come in who've lost and gained hundreds of pounds of weight. I mean, they've shown they can lose weight, but they can't keep it off. And they've certainly passed the grade for bariatric surgery.
So it's not just losing the weight, but it's also maintaining the weight
keeping
loss.
Keeping it off is very important.
Well, it's interesting because we see it's almost like the shoe is now on the other foot. We see physicians in the community referring patients for procedures, and the patients come to us like they want a second opinion. Well, I'm not sure. I don't know if I should go for it. And their insurance company is paying for it. So the issue used to be that they weren't getting coverage. Now they're getting coverage, and they're not going for it, which is a little bit mystifying to people who are in the obesity treatment community who feel like, wow, you know, this is a good opportunity. And if you look at the reasons that people all can tell you about a patient who had a bad outcome, or they'll tell you about someone who's regained weight. Those are the two leading causes. Well, why should I do it? I have a friend. But then if you ask them, they'll tell you about nine friends who lost the weight and maintained it, but they have one friend who regained the weight, and so they won't do it.
That's so true, because very often you hear patients telling you about the case they heard on newspapers that there was a bad outcome. And so they are afraid of bariatric surgery. As a matter of fact, bariatric surgery is one of the safest type of procedures we have in general surgery. The mortality rate today for bariatric surgery is well below 1%, 0.2, 0.3 is the average. And that corresponds to mortality rates that we only see in procedures like cholecystectomy, appendectomy, mm-hmm. hip replacement. So it is really interesting how patients who have a severe condition like diabetes or obesity sometimes don't appreciate the need to have a treatment that might have risks, of course, mm-hmm. but that there is effective, that is effective and could change their life forever. And finally, I would say another important issue, in my opinion, Lou, you say that insurance covers for bariatric surgery, and yet patients don't necessarily have are not coming more often for surgery. I think there is a misconception there that has a lot of implications for the treatment of obesity in general. The idea is that you could treat obesity or diabetes just by changing your lifestyle. And that would never happen if you, a patient had lung cancer and you see this patient, you ask him to stop smoking. Obviously, you would not expect stop smoking would cure the cancer. Mm-hmm. So we don't do the same thing with obesity. We think you can always reverse it, even when it has become a disease state that cannot be reversed only by changing lifestyle. So if patients understand that, and not only patients, referring physicians in the first place, understand the complexity of obesity and diabetes and how these conditions need to be aggressively treated, then maybe something might change and these procedures might be more acceptable.
It's clear that obesity is a very complex illness that begins as an environmental problem that starts in the environment but then takes on a physical presence. Something physical happens. The hypothalamus goes out of control, and it looks like that's what makes obesity so irreversible, that there's this ratcheting phenomenon that then keeps people going up and up and up. It's sort of a one-way trip up the stairs, and people just can't go back. And that's the thing that's been so mystifying, and until we can explain that to people, I think it's always going to be hard to get them to believe that it really is a physical phenomenon. But we've done studies showing that when we combine certain medications, a hormone from the fat cells, leptin, along with a medication, we can get animals to a much, much lower weight, proving that a lack of this hormone is a cause of the plateauing phenomenon. Unfortunately, we don't have the hormone to give yet, but these are the kinds of strategies that I think are going to really revolutionize the field in the future as we begin to develop these novel therapies. Gut peptides, there are many of them. You've been instrumental, Francesco, in trying to deconstruct surgery, figure out what exactly is going on, and then deliver those treatments to people. I think we're really going to begin to get some traction on the problem of obesity. So I think, unfortunately, it's time to wrap up our program for today. I want to thank all of our panelists for traveling here. It's really been an incredible discussion. I'm sure you all have learned a tremendous amount about obesity and about the management of your obese patients. This is the kind of problem that I hope will pique your interest and get you to look for more information about obesity management so that you can better treat patients. Interestingly, I recently found out that Medicare is considering paying for obesity treatment, and this could be a landmark because we could find that in a few years, 2 or 3 years, that many of the insurance plans will also be paying for obesity. So instead of waiting to treat the complications of obesity, which we're used to doing, waiting to treat the hypertension, the diabetes, the hyperlipidemia, we'll be treating the obesity when it first appears because it's covered by insurance, and we'll realize that that's the right thing to do. The studies are showing that it is the right thing to do because when you treat the obesity, not only do you get the diabetes, the hypertension, the hyperlipidemia, but you also get the quality of life issues, the arthritis, and the 49 other problems that are associated with obesity. So I'd like to thank our expert panelists, Dr. Caroline Apovian, Dr. Alan Schwartz, and Francesco Rubino for their participation. And I'd like to thank you, our audience, for tuning in today. Please take a moment to complete the post-activity questions that follow in order to earn CME credits along with the program evaluation. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Obesity and Comorbid Conditions, Clarifying the Bariatric Referral Roadmap. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.